countries face, and it is a real, real challenge.
Now, Mohammed bin Mabrouk, the spokesman for the pro-President July 25 movement in Tunisia, said that his country wants to join BRICS, a group of leading emerging economies comprising Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, that is often seen as an alternative to the Western hegemony. What's your take on these?
Now, the question is whether the BRICS are going to be moving into a more broader membership. And there's a number of countries who have said that they would like to join BRICS. We don't know whether BRICS will definitely agree to this or whether they will just continue to form and also have perhaps some kind of other mechanism for engaging other countries. But I think, again, their perspective, and you'll find this across the board, whether it's Brazil, China, India, again, their perspective is, again, for non-interference. Their perspective is for the sharing of, for working with other countries on a voluntary basis, as opposed to really sort of engaging in other types of in other types of geopolitical engagement. So I think it's still the space to watch for the BRICS and Tunisia's engagement with the BRICS, but definitely with the August summit, it will be very interesting to see what shape this takes. They will have a discussion about their membership, and it will be very interesting to see how Tunisia can engage thereafter.
EU leaders, including Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, have warned of the risks of an economic collapse in Tunisia that could drive more migrants to cross the Mediterranean Sea. Migrants from across Africa and Tunisia itself regularly use Tunisia's coastline, less than 150 kilometers from the Italian island of Lampedusa, as a springboard for attempts to reach Europe. Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani outlined Italy's position during a mid-April meeting with his Tunisian counterpart, Nabil Amar, in Rome.
Molto chiara quella italiana, sia al Fondo Monetario, sia ai nostri interlocutori.
Our proposal is very clear to the Monetary Fund and our interlocutors, Americans and Europeans. Our proposal is to start financing Tunisia through the Monetary Fund and deliver after a first tranche, a second tranche as the reforms proceed, but not utterly conditional on the conclusion of the reform process, to start financing and encourage the reforms.
As we have seen there, Italy says IMF should approve an initial unconditional bailout package for Tunisia. Now, is the request by Italian officials the right thing to do at this juncture?
Well, an unconditional bailout is definitely the right thing, and that's what most countries should be getting. When it came to COVID-19, there was a big agreement in 2021 at the IMF for $650 billion worth of special drawing rights. Tunisia did get some of those, but a very small proportion. The vast majority went to the largest countries in the world, and those were unconditional bailouts. So Tunisians are just as entitled as Italians, Americans, and others to be able to get bailouts from the IMF. On the other hand, I think the argument that it is a kind of migration issue and that is why the IMF should do something unconditional is the wrong kind of argument. It's the wrong kind of justification. With regards to what the argument should really be is about Tunisia and Tunisian citizens and their importance and their rights as humans.
Now, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have been termed by many as agents of Western and particularly American imperialism. Their policies and strategies are seen as promoting and imposing American and European influence in borrowing countries such as Tunisia. Now, do you agree with this perspective?
Well, I think there are certain facts which can justify that kind of perspective. For example, the head of the World Bank is always expected to be an American, American citizen, even if they might also have some other background. The head of the IMF is always expected to be a European, and this has been the case since they were created. In addition, the staffing within these institutions is, tends to be dominated because they're also based in the US. They do tend to be dominated by Americans. 25% of World Bank staff are Americans. At the same time, in many ways, the biggest issue with the institutions is not just about one nationality dominating or one particular nationality dominating. It really is about how do you ensure that these are institutions which are adaptable and flexible to the different economic theories of development and how development can happen, and they're open to different leaders who are ultimately responsible for their citizens and what they do, and that these are institutions that can respond to leaders who have different views on how they will achieve development for their citizens.
Very well put there. The IMF and the World Bank need to reform and adapt diverse policies unique to each country. I would like to thank our guest there, Hannah Rader, for her incisive analysis. And we now take a short break before our next topic on how Europe is exporting toxic pesticides to Africa.
Europe exporting toxic pesticides to Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
African parliamentarians have slammed European countries for exporting toxic pesticides that are killing the people of Africa and destroying the continent's environment.
Speakers at the Joint Parliament Assembly between the European Union and the African, Caribbean, and Pacific in Brussels early March accused EU countries of double standards by exporting to Africa toxic pesticides which are banned in the European Union. Additionally, Public Eye, a Swiss NGO, revealed that in the second half of last year, European companies issued notifications for the export of more than 380 tons of banned pesticides. The same companies plan to ship similar amounts this year. The destination of these deadly European pesticides is mostly in Africa.
An agriculture policy expert in Kenya says vegetables sold in the country's markets contain toxic pesticides banned in Europe.
A recent report by Route to Food Initiative just last year that showed that food bought from markets in Kenya in Kirinyaga County and Murang'a County have got toxic pesticides that are not approved for use in Europe, and yet they are being used in Kenya. 50 times more pesticides than we should be eating, which is not a wonder that we are opening cancer centers everywhere and Kenyans are sick because the food we're eating is not good for us.
Now, for more on how Europe is deliberately selling toxic pesticides to African countries, we have contacted Edward Wanyonyi, a disaster risk reduction researcher. Thanks for your time, sir. Now, pesticides that are harmful to health are banned in the EU, while at the same time, EU companies still export these dangerous pesticides to African countries. Now, why are Western countries employing double standards and clearly ready to kill Africans?
Thank you for that question. I think there is a challenge in terms of the entire engagement at the World Trade Organization level that looks at this component of hazardous waste, but it's also a failure of the international community in terms of allowing, you know, or practicing these double standards, because the same is not common in places like Asia. The same is not common in places like Middle East. But I think the challenge is that African countries are not being given the capacity to be able to negotiate better themselves out of this kind of situation. And also the capacity of African countries also to police, you know, and to grant maritime security for, you know, West, it becomes a challenge, because then they are not able to patrol enough, and priorities are just not aligned towards preventing this.
The Deputy Speaker of Uganda Parliament, Thomas Tayabwa, has condemned European Union member states exporting banned pesticides and products to developing countries. Speaking at the Organization of African, Caribbean, and Pacific Parliamentary Conference in Brussels, Belgium, early March, he also called on African countries to unite in confronting European Union countries selling toxic pesticides to the continent.
We are looking as if now, when it comes to issues of saying don't send us poison, each one is saying, no, go and handle it our own, your sovereign country. No, we are saying the EU, they didn't do it alone. They had to come as a group. We should also come as a group, and we say, if there are countries which are allowing this milk, which are allowing these poisonous pesticides, we should function as a group. Finally,
experts concur the joint action should be taken by African countries to stop the sales of these harmful pesticides by EU countries.
I think, one, there has to be some level of engagement at Africa Union level and a collective position agreed upon that should actually help member states to be able to proceed on with a level of deterrence. However, the challenge is that in the bigger scheme of things, most of these African countries will go behind the scenes and, you know, cut individual deals, which will actually be able to allow this practice to continue. But I see a situation whereby if member states can be able to endorse a common position at the Africa Union level, then there can be some level of collective engagement, because even at the regional level, they can be able to agree and say this is not going to accept it, and no member state will be allowed to be able to bring those hazardous and banned substances to their shores. So I feel that what is lacking is the Africa Union mechanism that can be able to collectively deal with this issue and ensure that member states are actually working towards a common position, and actually they have common enforcement measures, common deterrent measures, and they can actually be able to even take the countries which are doing this, you know, through a process of sanctions.
Gladys Boss-Cholet, the Deputy Speaker of Kenya's National Assembly, says if the European Union and Britain are allowing cancer-causing pesticides manufactured in their own countries exclusively to be exported to African countries, that's not an act of good faith. She says about 44% of pesticides used in Kenya are banned in America and Europe.
Honorable Speaker, about 44% of the total volume of pesticides used in Kenya are not allowed for use in Europe and other jurisdictions, but by some unexplainable double standards are still allowed and permitted in Kenya. In fact, these pesticides that I have pointed out have been banned in America and Europe, but their laws still allow them to manufacture them for export to countries that are ignorant enough and foolish enough to accept these products into our country. And that responsibility, Honorable Speaker, falls on the Pest Products Control Board, who have failed to undertake their due diligence and to protect the lives of Kenyans.
Now, what's your take on this statement?
I think it's just common knowledge that, your neighbor cannot be doing something wrong and they bring it to your side. And, you know, there's common decency. This is a shared level of humanity. So I think that context is just another pronouncement. But at the same time, the lady who has spoken is a Deputy National Assembly Speaker. So I wonder whether there is opportunity for her to raise these issues at the International Parliamentary Union, so that there is more consensus and more levels of advocacy around this issue. parliaments can also prepare, you know, a raft of measures to actually strengthen the levels of deterrence and ban of these substances so that they cannot come towards the shores. So I think the speaker, the deputy national speaker, has an opportunity to use this engagement to shed more light and provide more advocacy against this issue at the international level and also at the Africa Parliament level.
Cecilia Ogwal, Uganda's Dokolo District Women Representative, said that the EU should make a commitment to stop exporting hazardous substances to developing countries. She said their law says that you can continue making dangerous chemicals as long as you do not sell them in Europe. You can make the chemicals also purposely for export. We feel this is bad and an indirect way of eliminating Africa. Analysts say African parliaments should now take action locally and internationally to confront the U.S. and other European countries selling toxic pesticides, killing Africans.
I think the question is, what are these members of parliament doing and in spaces of advocacy, whether it's at the African Union level, whether it's at the East Africa community, and also at the international level? Most of these countries have representatives at the UN Assembly. So rather than complaining at a local level, they should be able to raise these issues at the UN Security Council and the UN Security General Assembly, so that then there is a collective position taken by these countries against the issue of EU dumping hazardous waste in Africa. Speaking at the local level will not help so much. We need to raise international attention to the issue and so that we can have a collective position.
In exporting banned pesticides to Africa, the US and EU countries are clearly in breach of their international obligations under the Basel Convention, customary law, and human rights law. Now, these countries that claim to respect international laws are engaged in blatant impunity that endangers the lives of African people. Why are they not being held accountable?
I think that is a question which is already self-answering. There has to be some level of advocacy to hold EU accountable. And whether that will be done by EU engagements at the level of the EU Parliament or whether it will be done by any other international actor, including the media, that should happen so that EU can be able to be called to order. Otherwise, we see a situation whereby people are claiming, you know, the wrong, but they're not doing so much. European voters are not raising their voice. You know, the collective World Assembly is not raising their voice. So I think it's a failure of the international system to actually hold such actors who are flaunting the international agreed positions accountable. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. The international community is to blame for failing to take action on Western powers exporting toxic pesticides that are killing Africans and destroying the continent's environment. I would like to thank our guest there, Edward Onyonyi, for his insight today. Well, and that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
The U.S. is exploiting the world through abusing its dollar hegemony and is using such power as a political tool to impose sanctions on other countries at will. However, efforts are underway around the world to topple the dollar. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to China Daily, the trend of de-dollarization in emerging markets is showing signs of an upsurge and convergence. Securities Times reported recently, quoting Zhang Roy, a member of the Chinese Association of Market Development. Zhang said China and Brazil have agreed to no longer use the U.S. dollar as an intermediate currency, but to directly conduct trade and financial transactions in their own currencies. Meantime, the Indian Ministry of External Affairs issued a statement stating that India and Malaysia have agreed to use the Indian rupee for trade settlement, furthermore, reducing dependence on the U.S. dollar in financial transactions and shifting toward local currency settlement has become the primary topic of discussion at the formal meeting of finance ministers and central bank governors of the 10 ASEAN countries. Zhang said the deal with Brazil follows China's agreements with more than 20 countries, including Russia, the United Arab Emirates, and Iraq, to settle some goods in local currencies. At the same time, many trades between Russia and Turkey, Iran and Turkey, India and Russia, Indonesia and Malaysia are conducted in non-dollar currencies. Zhang added that while doing their best to get rid of the shekels of the dollar in trade, emerging market countries are also choosing to dilute their allocation and dependence on the dollar and its financial products in their foreign exchange reserves. According to the data, China's holdings of the U.S. government bond dropped to $859.4 billion, the lowest level in 14 years. Russia, meanwhile, holds just $67 million in U.S. government bond, down 2,600% from a decade ago, while Saudi Arabia's holdings have fallen from $184.4 billion a decade ago to $111 billion, a net sell-off rate of 40%. In addition, countries such as India and Brazil are simultaneously reducing their holdings of U.S. government bond. Zhang said self-built trade transaction mechanism has become a common institutional arrangement for emerging market countries. For example, Russia has built its own payment system, SPFS, which has 469 institutions, including 115 foreign entities in 14 countries. Similarly, China has also created its own trade settlements of tool, CIPS, which has attracted 1,427 institutions covering 109 countries and regions around the world. More generally, BRICS countries are preparing to create their own unified payment system, BRICS Pay, which is expected to be discussed further at the BRICS summit in South Africa in August. Zhang said, compared with developed economies, emerging market countries are more active to de-dollar. The main reason is that emerging market countries have suffered more than the dollar, and it is more urgent to get rid of the shekels of the dollar. Also, according to CGTN, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and other countries have also taken measures to accelerate the process of de-dollarization, such as selling U.S. bonds, relinquishing the use of the U.S. dollar as currency for settlement, and issuing digital currencies. Other countries have also rolled out a slew of alternatives to the U.S. dollar. After an oil price cap was imposed on Russia in December, Indian buyers have paid for Russian oil in non-dollar currencies, including the UAE dirham and the Russian ruble. Multiple oil trading and banking sources told Reuters. Argentina and Brazil began talks in January to create a common currency as part of a coordinated bid to reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar. Discussions on how the new currency, which Brazil suggests calling the SUR, meaning the South, could boost regional trade and reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar, were planned. Financial Times reported recently, citing officials. The U.S. dollar reserve currency system is coming to an end, and we are moving towards a multipolar reserve system, said Bobby Malavi, managing director at Goldman Sachs.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Iran is a country rich in culture, history, and art. The countless historical monuments scattered across the land are manifest proof of the glory of the ancient Persian civilization. And the development of modern-day Iran is evident in its major cities and metropolitan centers. But perhaps what's remained hidden from both foreign and domestic tourists are some of Iran's stunning natural treasures. I'm Daniel Arya. As the 18th largest country in the world, Iran offers a full gamut of climates and geographical attractions, from mountains and deserts to forests and caves. Iran's diverse and dramatic landscapes offer some truly awe-inspiring and unspoiled views to discover. In this week's program, we will follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the southern regions of Iran, where the hot sand dunes of the desert meet the turquoise and tranquil waters of the Sea of Oman. Stay with us.
Travel is the most important thing in life to me. The reason I travel so much to the unknown spots of my motherland is that I want to discover the hidden beauties of its environment and to meet its diverse ethnic groups. I believe that city dwellers, with all their knowledge, education, and modernity, must have a good relationship with the natural environment and with nature dwellers in order to live a richer, more peaceful life. A relationship like this is vital for our survival in the world we live in. It's early February. In this season, temperatures can plunge to minus 40 degrees in the towering Mount Damavand region. But I've come to a part of Iran where the temperature is as high as 20 degrees above, perfect for a good long trip in the winter. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and this time I have traveled to the southernmost spot in my beloved country, Iran. Follow me to one of the most beautiful and pristine areas of my country, in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. To be exact, my destination is the southernmost area of the vast Balochistan region. In terms of culture and ethnic groups, Sistan and Balochistan province is divided into two parts: Sistan in the north and Balochistan in the south. During my many trips to the natural beauties of beloved Iran, I have come across multiple beautiful mountains and spent time traversing most of them, from freezing tall rocky mountains to forested highlands to those sitting on the hot and dry deserts of Iran. But this time, on one leg of my trip to Sistan and Balochistan province, I'm supposed to find mountains that are impossible to climb. The shape of these mountains, or should I say hills, is unique and beautiful. The locals and tourists who have visited this area have named these hills Martian Mountains. Many believe that the rocky formations in this part of Iran are very similar to those on the surface of planet Mars. Geological experts say these hills are sediments at the bottom of a sea that used to be here millions of years ago, were initially buried under millions of tons of soil following the change in the shape of the Earth's crust over the years, and were later unearthed as a result of climatic changes and monsoon rains that washed away the dirt, exposing the real face of these bizarre hills. These mountains are among the most beautiful in Iran, in my opinion. They are no less beautiful than Mount Damavand that's been registered as a national heritage. I hope the Martian mountains of Sistan and Balochistan province, of the Balochistan area in the Chabahar region to be exact, are also put on the national heritage list. The thrust of the Gulf of Oman oceanic crust under the southern area of Balochistan, in addition to wind and water erosions, are among the reasons behind the emergence of these beautiful elevations. They are made up of sedimentary rocks containing clay and lime. The beautiful furrows on their exterior have been carved out by centuries of erosion. The heights of Martian hills vary from one area to another. At their shortest, they stand at more than 5 meters tall, and at their highest, more than 100 meters. At first glance, these hills, referred to as badlands by geologists, may look like they are not very resistant, but you will change your mind once you inspect them up close, although they're not resistant enough against the rain and water of Balochistan. In the midst of these mountains is a plain where rainwater has accumulated over many years, creating a spectacular lagoon by the name of Lipar. Environmentally, Lipar, with its many and varied animal and plant species, is an important lagoon in the region. It is an important feature of the natural environment in Balochistan. The local population use water from the lagoon for their animals and in farming. I'm on my way to one of the most beautiful valleys in the Martian Mountains. I've named it the Snail Valley. If you want to know why I picked that name for it, follow me. We walk for about an hour to get to the mouth of the valley. Floodwaters set off by seasonal rains have created a beautiful and unspoiled valley and cave. This is the Nahadi Cave. It acts as the entrance to the Snail Valley. My good friend here, Shir Muhammad, was kind enough to come here from Berries to help me find this cave and walk through it to the valley. I'm sure we are in for a treat. Am I right? The valley, I mean the Snail Valley, is a very long and deep gorge that leads to the Terap Mountain. Terap is what the locals call that mountain. The reason I named this the Snail Valley is because this place is littered with shell fossils. You can see them everywhere in this mountain and in this valley. Beautiful shell fossils that have adorned this boulder and this whole area. All the exterior walls of these Martian or miniature mountains and inside the Snail Valley is covered with these shells that have turned into fossil. Another reason is that this valley looks exactly like a snail. It meanders through the mountain from beginning to end. In some places, it wraps around itself and sends you going around in circles before you can get to the other end of it. The Snail Valley is so curvy. It's one of the most beautiful gorges in the Balochistan region. And let's not forget that if a place has a local name attached to it, we should never try and put a new name on it. We must follow the tradition of the locals who have inherited that name from their forefathers, from their ancestors. So once again, we should use the same names as they do. The gorge is almost impassable in some parts, but I am so enchanted by its beauty, I've decided to move as far as humanly possible. Its many twists and turns and the millions of fossils on its walls have redoubled my resolve to move forward. We are around 10 kilometers away from the Sea of Oman. This is a very high altitude. Obviously, thousands, in other words, millions of years ago, this whole area had been under the Sea of Oman, part of what used to be the Tethys Ocean. These fossil shells date back to that time. These are millions of years old. Every time I step into valleys or Martian hills like these, I'm filled with utter joy. But I'd never take any of these back home with me or use them as ornaments. All I do is pick them up, snap photos of them, and put them back where I found them, to share all these beauties with posterity. We must protect these treasures. We are their guardians. We walk a long way and eventually arrive at a dead end. That's when we have to trace our way back. Fortunately, there are no construction operations going on anywhere close to the Martian Mountains, and that adds to the beauty and magnificence of the area. After my visit to the Martian Hills, I continue my journey to one of the most beautiful semi-traditional wharfs in Iran, the Berries Fisherman's Wharf. It is operated by the inhabitants of Berries Village, perched on top of these escarpments. Before the village was relocated to the top of the coastal cliffs, it used to be somewhere on the sand beach. Today, the locals call it Old Berries. The villagers moved from Old Berries to New Berries around 20 years ago. One of the most important reasons for their relocation was the strong winds in the area that would blow for 120 days in a row and dump sand and dust on the village. The second reason was the beautiful Berries Wharf. The architecture used in the homes and other buildings in Baluchistan has vividly been inspired by Indian and Pakistani architectural designs. They use different, beautiful, vibrant colors in their buildings. The old mosque here is located in the area where Old Berries used to be. The rest of the village lies in ruins. They stripped the old buildings of their doors and windows and used them in their buildings in New Berries. But they have left this mosque intact. Everything in this mosque is there, just as it has always been. That's because the Muslim population in Baluchistan have utmost respect for their mosques and sacred buildings. They never demolish them. They abandon such buildings and let nature take its course. The main occupation of the people of Berries is fishing. The men of this land depend on the sea for their livelihood. Some strike out to the sea in small boats and throw their small nets in to catch fish. Others go out in wooden launches, which could be called the biggest of man-made contraptions. They go out to sea and spend months fishing. These large wooden motorboats are equipped with proper refrigerators and air conditioning for the crew. The fishermen here say they are not happy with their catches in recent years. They say marine life populations have shrunk drastically. The declining numbers of fish in seas and oceans has its cause in different and important reasons. The first reason behind the decrease in the numbers of marine life around the world is the boom in the human population on Earth. The growth in the human population has led to a larger demand for fish and in turn to overfishing by those in the fishing industry. Operations that are carried out via large ocean-going trawlers fitted with radars and other high-tech equipment. Ships that have nets running several kilometers and by means of radars can trap thousands of fish in every attempt in the depths of oceans. In almost every catch, these ships bring home fish weighing upwards of 300,000 kilos altogether. Industrial fishing and the overconsumption of marine life by humans leaves the fish no time to reproduce, pushing many species to the brink of extinction. In a recent survey, researchers at the University of British Columbia found that in half a century, human consumption has pushed down big fish populations by 90%, fish that are in high demand on the market. They have predicted that if serious action is not taken against overfishing by developed countries, all these species of fish will have gone extinct by 2050. Marine life populations are on the decline, which will have dire consequences for humans and the environment alike. The ecosystems of seas and oceans are intertwined with the lives of humans and the environment they live in. They're all very fragile. Iran accounts for only a small portion of the marine life caught around the world. The reasons being high prices, the small share the marine animals have of the Iranian diet, and the absence of advanced fishing vessels in the country. But European countries, the United States, Japan, and many other developed countries play an important role in the destruction of marine ecosystems. They have done more damage to the environment than any other country in the world. And this is a result of a boom in their populations, a change in consumption patterns, and the lifestyle of the people living in those countries. There are two other important reasons that have contributed to the dwindling numbers of marine animals: contamination and global warming. Berris is a very beautiful wharf. It was built at the foot of the Berris cliffs, offering a spectacular view. Launches and boats return here with their catch of the day to sell their prized sea creatures to the middleman. Beautiful the fellow is. The local fishermen here call it the kilkita in their local dialect. It's so colorful. Unfortunately, she too is still carrying her eggs. They get caught in the fisherman's net in this season. Most of those I've seen were ready to spawn. This is their time to reproduce, but they don't get the chance to do it. They are pulled out of the water along with the thousands of eggs that they are carrying in their abdomens. Poor thing is struggling to get out of my hand. Just look how beautiful it is. So colorful. One of the fishermen gave me this lobster and said I could have it, but I'm gonna let it go because it's carrying so many eggs. After my visit to Berry's wharf, I set off on a walking journey along the shores of the Sea of Oman. Of course, I'll be walking on the cliffs all along. The view from atop the cliffs in Berris is simply matchless. Fortunately, there aren't constructions of any kind up here. The area is an asset for Balochistan and indeed for Iran because of its pristineness. I hope to see the same unspoiled beauties and pristineness the next time I visit this part of my country and its beautiful landscape. I hope more and more tourists come to visit Balochistan. Nature travelers go to places that are pristine and untouched in order to immerse themselves in the peace and quiet that those places offer. Beautiful rocky cliffs are where Berris begins. Those are the shores of Berris, among the most beautiful of our beloved country, Iran. But the bluff along the shore is crumbling into the sea. The waves lap at the walls made up of millennia-old sediments that settled on the bottom of the Sea of Oman that used to cover this whole area. The bluff is capped by a 2-meter-high layer of rock, like the one I'm sitting on right now. It feels like reinforced mortar with all the shells and algae in it, fossils that I have been here for thousands, or should I say millions of years. But the layers underneath are weak and brittle, allowing the waves to chip away at them one bit at a time. The green blocks or rocks that you see on the coast are in fact the top layer of the cliff. They used to be up where I am right now. It's going to take the waves some time to turn them into sand and dissolve them in the water. It's about 60 meters down to the foot of the cliff, and as you can see, a huge slice of the cliff has splintered from the rest, or should I say from Barry's territory, and will crash into the sea one of these days. So I better cross onto the other side because it's dangerous to stand here. I really don't want to go down with it. This gaping crack here is almost 10 meters deep, but it's very likely for it to be much deeper in other parts. It's too dark for me to see. This is a very dangerous spot.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei in a meeting with Iranian officials and the ambassadors of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr on April 22, 2023. If the Islamic nation, which consists of about 2 billion, close to 2 billion people, who are scattered in the most important sensitive geographical areas of the world, if they were united today, Islamic countries would receive more blessings, far more blessings. If this unity is established to any extent, the solution to the problems of the Islamic world would become apparent. The first step will become apparent and it will be possible for us to solve the problems of the Islamic world. The Islamic world is facing many problems now. It is faced with differences, conflicts, bloodshed, dependence on others, poverty, and the lack of knowledge. These are problems in the Islamic nation. If we become closer to one another, not only will solving these problems become possible, it will also be easy to do. The issue of Palestine is currently one of the most fundamental issues of the Islamic world. Even if it's not at the top of the issues, it is at least one of the top problems of the Islamic world.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Praise God, today we are witnessing the gradual decline of the usurping Zionist regime. Everyone in the world is seeing this. The usurping regime is gradually declining, and the rate of its decline is increasing every day. This decline started some years ago, but the rate of its decline has increased. This is a very big opportunity. The Palestinian issue is not just an Islamic issue. It is a humanitarian issue. If anyone in the world, regardless of whether they are Muslim or not, knows the reality of the events in Palestine, they will confront the usurping Zionist regime. Some of the crimes of the usurping regime, the Israeli regime that is, and some of the catastrophes that they had created became apparent to the world this year. You saw how the people's gatherings and walks on Quds Day were no longer limited to the Islamic world. Many people outside the Islamic world, even in Europe and in America itself, also took part in the walks in defense of the Palestinian people. This is how it is. It is a humanitarian issue. What is it that makes a European person whose government is attached to and dependent on the Zionist regime chant in the streets in favor of the Palestinians and against the Zionist regime? This is a very important matter. Why has it become like this? It is because of the Palestinian people's resistance.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On Thursday, about 6,000 employees from the Italian phone carrier Wind Tre walked out of work in protest against the management's decision to spin off the firm's network assets into a separate company. Wind Tre is the third largest Italian mobile operator with about 20 million customers and the second largest fixed line operator with almost 3 million subscribers. The industrial action had been called by Italy's three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and UIL, against the unbundling deal, which unions and workers say is the prelude to mass layoffs.
We have to stand united against this spin-off. Breaking up companies always leads to detrimental consequences for workers. The best case scenario is that we get further stripped of working rights. The worst is thousands of layoffs.
The spin-off of telecoms operator Wind Tre will pave the way for the sale of a majority stake in the grid company to Swedish private equity firm EQT. Unionists say Wind Tre will shift some 2,000 workers out of a total 6,500 workers in Italy into the network venture.
Sta cambiando il modello industriale.
The industrial system as a whole is shifting towards a new paradigm in the communication sector, which features separating the management of the network grid from that of services. This way, Italy will further lose control on its strategic assets, and many smaller companies will kick in, exacerbating job insecurity in the country.
Job insecurity is rampant in Italy. According to statistical agency Eurostat's figures, Italy has the second lowest employment rate for young workers in Europe at about 30%. Also, Italy has no minimum wage but protects workers through collective agreements, which often remains a dead letter for people on precarious contracts. Meanwhile, Italy's government has scrapped an anti-poverty benefit that goes under the name of citizen income, replacing it with a more limited inclusion check for qualifying households starting from January 2024. Prime Minister Meloni argues that the citizen income, which helped about 4 million people last year, costs too much and discourages people, especially youths, from looking for jobs.
Personally,
I have been forever looking for a dignifying job, but the only things I'm offered are badly paid long-hour jobs. The citizen income should have been amended, but not scrapped altogether.
Nearly half of workers...